You can try to smoke the house, Drefin offered. Erling grunted.
We did that in Sparrowville. All cures and preventatives, too. But people died just the same.
I know, Drefin said. I wish there was something I could do, but I've never heard of a sure cure. If you know of anything that you think helped when you were young, then try it. I don't know of all the treatments by any means. At worst, it could do no harm, and at best may help. Erling set the plane aside.
Some folk burned fires hot that summer, trying to drive the sickness from their blood. Some said it was because their blood was too hot already with the high summer heat, and with the fever on top of that, and tried to fan their loved ones to cool their blood. Which would you advise?
Drefin shook his head. I'm sorry, but I just don't know. I've heard of people recovering when each was tried, and I've heard of people dying just the same with each. Some things are out of our hands. No one can stay the Keeper's hand when he comes. Erling rubbed his scruffy chin.
I'll pray that the good spirits spare the girls.
His voice caught.
They're too good, too innocent for the Keeper to touch them just yet. They've brought untold joy to this house and family.
Drefin returned his hand to Erling's shoulder. I'm sorry, Master Anderson, but Lily has the tokens upon her. Erling gasped and gripped the bench. Drefin had been ready and caught him under his arms to keep him from falling when his knees gave out. Drefin helped him to sit on the carving horse. Colin turned her face away and put it to Richard's shoulder when Erling covered his tears with both hands. Richard felt numb.
Grandpa?
Darby called from the steps.
What's wrong?
Erling straightened.
Nothing, boy. I'm just worried about your sisters, that's all. Old men get foolish, that's all.
Darby eased the rest of the way down the stairs.
Yannick, I'm real sorry about Kip. If your pa needs anything, I'm sure my pa would let me leave my work and get help.
Yannick nodded. He looked in a daze, too. Richard squatted down before the boys. Did either of you see anything strange at the Jala game?
Strange?
Darby asked.
Strange like what?
Richard combed his fingers back through his hair. I don't know. Did you talk to any strangers?
Sure,
Darby said.
There were lots of people there we didn't know. Soldiers were there watching the game. Lots of people I didn't know came to congratulate us after we won.
Do any of them stand out in your mind? Anything odd about any of them?
I saw Kip talking to a man and a woman after the game,
Yannick said.
More than like they were just congratulating him. They were leaning down, talking to him, showing him something.
Showing him something? What?
I'm sorry, Yannick said, but I didn't see. I was too busy getting slapped on the back by soldiers.
Richard was trying not to frighten the boy with his questions, but he had to press for answers. What did this man and woman look like?
I don't know,
Yannick said. His eyes were filling with tears at remembering his brother alive.
The man was skinny and young. The woman was young, too, but not as young as he. She was kind of pretty, I guess. She had brown hair,
he pointed at Nadine.
Like hers, but not as thick or as long.
Richard glanced up at Colin. By the stricken look on her face, he knew she was fearing the same thing as he.
I remember them, Darby said. My sisters talked to that man and woman, too.
But neither of you talked to them.
No,
Darby said. Yannick shook his head.
We were jumping around, excited that we'd won the game in front of Lord Raw. A lot of the soldiers were congratulating us, and so were a lot of other people. I never talked to those two.
Richard took Colin's hand. Colin and I have to go ask Beth and Lily a question, he said to Drefin. We'll be right back. Pressed close together, seeking support in each other's touch, they climbed the stairs. Richard was dreading what he might hear from the girls. You ask them, Richard whispered to her. They're afraid of me. They'll talk easier to you.
Do you think it could have been them?
Richard didn't need to ask who she was talking about. I don't know. But you told me that your gang said he had watched the Jala game through Marlin's eyes. Sister Amelia was with Marlin. They were doing something here in Aidendrill. Richard reassured the women that they just had a small question to ask the girls. The women busied themselves with their work while he went with Colin back into the bedroom. Richard doubted they were paying any more attention to their meat pies than Erling had been with the chair seat he had been planing.
Lily,
Colin asked the younger girl, first in a soft voice as she smiled,
do you remember when you went to watch your brother play Jala?
Lily nodded.
He won. We were real happy that he won. Pa said Dobby scored a point.
Yes, we saw him play, and we were happy for him, too. Do you remember the two people you talked to, a man and a woman?
She frowned.
When Ma and Pa were cheering? That man and woman?
Yes. Do you remember what they said to you?
Beth was holding my hand. They asked if he was my brother we was cheering for.
That's right,
Beth said from the other bed. She had to stop talking as she was taken with a bout of coughing. When she recovered and caught her breath, she went on.
They said Darby played really good. They showed us the pretty thing they had.
Richard stared at her. Pretty thing?
The shiny thing in the box,
Lily said.
That's right,
Beth said.
They let me and Lily see it.
What was it? Beth frowned through her headache.
It was, I don't know exactly. It was in a box that was so black you couldn't see its sides. The shiny thing inside was pretty.
Lily nodded her agreement.
My Dow saw it too. She thought it was real pretty too.
Do you have any idea what it was? They both shook their heads. It was in a box that was as black as midnight. To look at it is like looking down a dark hole, Richard said. They both nodded.
Sounds like the Night Stone,
Colin whispered to him. Richard knew well that blackness. Not only the Night Stone had been like that, but also the outer covering of the boxes of Orton. It was a color so sinister that it seemed to suck the very light from a room. In Richard's experience, that void of light was only associated with immensely dangerous things. The Night Stone could bring beings forth from the underworld, and the boxes of Orton held magic that, if used for evil, could destroy the world of life. The boxes could open a gateway to the underworld. And inside was something shiny, Richard said. Was it like looking at a candle or the flame of a lamp, that kind of shiny?
Colors,
Lily said.
It was pretty colors. Like colored light,
Beth said.
It was sitting on white sand.
Sitting on white sand. The hairs on the back of Richard's neck stood on end. How big was the box? Beth held her hands not quite a foot apart.
About this big on a side, but it wasn't very thick. Kind of like a book. It was almost like they opened a book. That's what the box reminded me of. A book.
And inside, the sand that was inside, did it have lines drawn in it? Kind of like if you were to draw lines in dry dirt with a stick? Beth nodded as she succumbed to a bout of rattling coughs. She panted, catching her breath when they finally ceased.
That's right. Neat lines in patterns. That's just what he was like. He was a box, or maybe a big book, and when they opened it to show us the pretty colors, it had white sand in it with careful lines drawn in it. Then we saw the pretty colors.
You mean there was something sitting in the sand? This thing that made the colored light was sitting in the sand? Beth blinked in confusion, trying to remember.
No. It was more like the light came out of the sand.
She flopped back on her bed and rolled on her side in obvious distress from her sickness, from the plague, from black death, from a black box. Richard stroked a hand tenderly down her arm and pulled the blanket back up over her as she moaned in pain.
Thank you, Beth. You rest now and get yourself better.
Richard couldn't thank Lily. He dared not trust his voice. Lily lay back, her tiny little brow puckered.
I'm tired.
She pouted near tears.
I don't feel good.
She curled up and put her thumb in her mouth. Colin tucked Lily in and promised her a treat as soon as she was well. Colin's tender smile brought a small smile to Lily's mouth. It almost made Richard smile. Almost. In the alley, after they had left the Anderson house, Richard pulled Dreffen aside. Colin told the others to wait, and then she joined them. "What are tokens?" Richard asked. "You told the grandfather that the youngest had tokens on her." "Those spots on her legs are called tokens." "And why was the old man nearly struck down with dread when he heard you say the girl had them?"
Dreffen's blue eyes turned away. "People die of the plague in different ways. I don't know the reason, except to imagine it has something to do with their constitution. The strength and vulnerability of everyone's aura is different. I've not seen with my own eyes all manner of death the plague causes, as, thankfully, it is a rare occurrence. Some of what I know I learned from the records that the Rochmos keep. The plagues I've seen have been in small, remote places. In the past, many centuries ago, there have been a few great plagues in large cities, and I've read the records of those. With some people it comes on of a sudden, very high fevers, intolerable headaches, vomiting, searing pains in their backs. They are out of their minds with the agony of it for many days, even weeks, before they die. A few of these recover. Beth is like that. She will get much worse yet. I have seen people like her recover. She has a small chance. Sometimes they look like the first boy, with the Black Death overwhelming them and rotting their bodies. Others are tortured with horribly painful swellings in their neck, armpits, or groin. They suffer miserably until they finally die. Birth is like that. If the distemper can be brought to a head and encouraged to break and run, then they occasionally recover.
What about Lily?
Colin asked.
What about these tokens, as you call them?
I've never seen them before, with my own eyes, but I've read about them in our records. The tokens will appear on the legs and sometimes on the chest. People who have the tokens rarely know they are sick until the end. They will one day discover to their horror that they have the tokens upon them and be dead shortly thereafter. They die with little or no pain, but they all die. No one with tokens on them ever lives. The old man must have seen them before because he knew this. The plagues I've seen, as violent as the outbreaks were, never displayed the tokens. The records say that the worst of the great plagues, the ones that brought the most widespread death, were marked with the tokens. Some people thought they were visible signs of the Keeper's fatal touch.
But Lily is just a little girl,
Colin protested, as if arguing could change it.
She doesn't seem so sick. It isn't possible for her to...
Lily is feeling out of sorts. The tokens on her legs are fully developed. She will be dead before midnight.
Tonight?
Richard asked in astonishment.
Yes, at the very latest. More likely within hours, I think. Perhaps even... A woman's long, shrill scream came from the house. The horror in it sent a shiver through Richard's bones. The soldiers who had been talking in low voices off at the end of the alley fell silent. The only sound was a dog barking down the next street. A man's anguished cry came from the house. Dreffen closed his eyes.
As I was about to say, even sooner...
Colin buried her face against Richard's shoulder. She clutched his shirt. Richard's head spun.
"The children," she wept. "That bastard is killing children."
Dreffen's brow bunched.
"What's she talking about?"
"Dreffen." Richard tightened his arms around Colin as she shook. "I think these children are dying because a wizard and a sorceress went to a Jala game a few days back and used magic to start this plague."
"That's not possible. It takes longer than that for people to fall sick.
The wizard was the one who hurt Kara when you first arrived. He left a prophecy on the wall in the pit. It begins, 'On the red moon will come the firestorm.'" Dreffen regarded him with a dubious frown.
"How can magic start a plague?"
"I don't know,"
Richard whispered. He couldn't bear to speak aloud the next part of the prophecy. "The one bonded to the blade will watch as his people die. If he does nothing, then he and all those he loves will die in its heat. For no blade, forged of steel or conjured of sorcery, can touch this bow. Colin trembled in his arms, and he knew she was agonizing over the final part of the prophecy. To quench the inferno, he must seek the remedy in the wind. Lightning will find him on that path, for the one in white, his true beloved, will betray him in her blood. Chapter 31. At the edge of the expansive palace grounds, a patrol of Daharan soldiers spotted them and snapped to attention. Just beyond the soldiers, in the streets of the city, Colin could see people everywhere going about their business, pause to bow to the Mother Confessor and the Lord Rawl. Although the activities of commerce, on the surface, seemed like any other day, Colin thought she could detect subtle differences. Men loading barrels into a wagon scrutinized people who passed close by. Shopkeepers appraised customers carefully. People walking on the street skirted those stopped in conversation. The knots of people gossiping seemed more numerous. Laughter was conspicuously absent from the streets. After they had solemnly saluted with fists to the leather armor and chainmail over their hearts, the patrol of soldiers not far off broke into good-natured grins.
"Huzzah, Lord Rawl!"
they cheered as one.
"Huzzah, Lord Rawl!" "Thank you, Lord Rawl,"
one of the soldiers shouted toward them.
"You cured us, restored our health. We're well because of you. Long live the great wizard, Lord Rawl!"
Richard froze in mid-stride, not looking at the soldiers, but staring at the ground before him. His cloak, snared in a gust of wind, embraced him, shrouding him in its golden sparkles. The others joined in.
"Long live Lord Rawl! Long live Lord Rawl!"
Hands balled in fists, Richard started out once more without looking their way. Colin, her arm around his, slid her hand down and urged his fist open to twine her fingers in his. She gave his hand a squeeze of silent understanding and support. From the corner of her eye, Colin could see Kara, back behind Drefin and Nadine, gesturing angrily at the patrol to silence them and move them along. In the distance before them, on a gentle rise, the expanse of the Confessor's palace rose up in all its splendor of stone columns, vast walls and elegant spires, standing out a pristine white against the darkening sky. Not only was the sun going down, but murky clouds scudded by, messengers delivering a vow of a storm. A few errant snowflakes flitted past on the wind, scouting for the horde to come. Spring had not yet prevailed. Colin gripped Richard's hand as if clutching at life itself. In her mind's eye, she saw nothing but sickness and death. They had seen near to a dozen sick children, stricken with plague. Richard's pallid face looked hardly better than the six dead faces she had seen. Her insides ached. Holding back her tears, her cries, her screams had cramped her stomach muscles. She had told herself that she couldn't lose control and cry in front of mothers who were terrified that their sick children might be sicker than they had imagined, or as sick as they knew, but refused to believe. Many of these mothers were hardly older than Colin. They were just young women, faced with a crushing plight, who fell to piteous prayer for the good spirits to spare their precious children. Colin couldn't say that she wouldn't have been reduced to the same state in their place. Some of the parents, like the Andersons, had older members of their families to rely on for advice and support. But some of the mothers were young and alone, with only husbands hardly more than boys themselves, and no one to turn to. Colin put her free hand over the painful spasm in her abdomen. She knew how devastated Richard felt. He had more than enough to carry on his shoulders. She had to be strong for him. Majestic maple trees stood to each side, the bare thicket of branches laced together over their heads. It wouldn't be long before they budded. They passed out from the tunnel of trees onto the winding promenade that led up to the palace. Behind them, Drefin and Nadine carried on a whispered discussion of herbs and cures to be tried. Nadine would propose something, and Drefin would give his opinion as to whether it would be useless or might be worth trying. He would gently lecture her on the paths of infirmity, and the causes of breaks in the body's defenses that allowed an affliction to gain hold. Colin got the vague impression that he almost seemed to view those who fell sick with contempt, as if because they took so little care with their auras and flows of energy that he talked about all the time, it was only to be expected that they would succumb to a pestilence unworthy of those like himself who minded their bodies better. She guessed that one with his knowledge of healing people must get frustrated with those who brought disease upon themselves, like the prostitutes and the men who went to them. She was relieved, at least, that he wasn't one of those. Colin wasn't sure if she felt Jeffin was justified in some of the things he was saying, or if it was simple arrogance. She herself had felt frustration at people who flouted dangers to their health. When she was younger, there was a diplomat who became ill every time he ate rich sauces with certain spices. They always left him with difficulty breathing. He loved the sauces. Then one time, at a formal dinner, he gorged himself on the sauces he loved and fell dead at the table. Colin could never understand why the man would bring such sickness on himself, and had trouble feeling sorry for him. In fact, she always viewed him with contempt when he came to a formal dinner. She wondered if Jeffin didn't feel much the same way about some people, except that he knew much more of what made people sick. She had seen Jeffin do remarkable things with Kara's aura, and she knew, too, that sickness could sometimes be influenced by the mind. Colin had, on a number of occasions, stopped in a small place called Langdon, where lived a very superstitious and backward people. It was decided by their powerful local healer that the headaches that so bothered the people of Langdon must be caused by evil spirits possessing them. He ordered white hot irons put to the bottoms of the feet of those with headaches to drive out the evil spirits. It was a remarkable cure. No one in Langdon was ever possessed again. The headaches vanished. If only the plague could vanish so easily. If only Nadine could vanish so easily. They couldn't send her away now, when there would be so much need among the people. Like it or not, Nadine was going to be around until this was over. Shota seemed to be tightening her clutches around Richard. Colin didn't know what Richard had said to Nadine, but she could imagine. Nadine had suddenly been stricken with overt politeness. Colin knew Nadine's apology hadn't been sincere. Richard had probably told her that if she didn't apologize, he would boil her alive. With the way Kara's gaze so often passed over Nadine, Colin suspected that Nadine had more to worry about than Richard. Colin and Richard led the rest of their group between the towering white columns set to each side of the entrance, through the open doors carved with geometric designs, and into the palace. The cavernous grand hall inside was lit by windows of pale blue glass, set between polished white marble columns topped with gold capitals, and by dozens of lamps spaced along the walls. A leather-clad figure in the distance wandered toward them across the black and white marble squares. Someone else approached from the right side from the guest rooms. Richard slowed to a stop and turned. "Ulick, would you please go find General Curson? He might be at the Dharin headquarters. Does anyone know where General Baldwin is?"
"He's probably at Kelton's palace on King's Row," Colin said. "He's been staying there since he arrived and helped us defeat the Blood of the Fold."
Richard nodded wearily. Colin didn't think she had ever seen him looking worse. His spiritless eyes stared out from an ashen face. He swayed on his feet as he squinted, looking for Egan, not 10 feet away.
"Egan, there you are. Go get General Baldwin, please. I don't know where he is, but you can ask around."
Egan cast a quick, uneasy glance toward Colin. "Would you like us to bring anyone else, Lord Rawl?"
"Anyone else?"
"Yes. Tell them to bring their officers. I'll be in my office. Bring them there."
Ulick and Egan both clapped fists to hearts before turning to their duties. As they departed, they conveyed a message through quick hand signals to the two moored Sith. In response, Kara and Rayna maneuvered closer to Richard, screening him as Tristan Bashkar came to a wary halt. Verdine meandered up on the other side, her rapt attention on the open journal in her hands. She seemed completely absorbed in what she was studying and oblivious to anything around her. Colin put out a hand to stop her before she bumped into Richard. She rocked to a halt like a rowboat that had drifted in and grounded on the shore. Tristan bowed.
Father Confessor? Lord Rawl? Who are you?
Richard asked. Tristan Bashkar of Jarrow, Lord Rawl. I'm afraid we haven't been formally introduced. Life sparked into Richard's gray eyes.
And have you decided to surrender, Minister Bashkar?
Tristan had been about to bow again at an expected formal introduction. He hadn't expected Richard's questions to come first. He cleared his throat and straightened. His easy smile welled onto his face.
Lord Rawl, I do appreciate your indulgence. The Mother Confessor has graciously granted me 2 weeks to observe the signs from the stars.
Power came to Richard's voice.
You risk your people seeing swords instead of stars, Minister.
Tristan unbuttoned his coat. From the corner of her eye, Colin saw Kara's Ajeel twitch up into her hand. Tristan didn't notice. His gaze stayed on Richard while he drew his coat back, holding it open casually by resting his fist on his hip. It exposed the knife at his belt. Reyna flicked her Ajeel up into her hand.
Lord Rawl, as I explained to the Mother Confessor, our people looked forward with great joy to joining with the Dharan Empire.
The Dharan Empire?
Tristan, Colin said, we're rather busy at the moment. We have discussed this already, and you have been given 2 weeks. Now, if you will excuse us.
Tristan brushed back a lock of his hair, his bright brown eyes taking her in.
I'll get to the point, then. I've heard rumors that plague is loose in Aedendrill.
Richard's raptor glower was suddenly in full form.
It's not just a rumor, it's true.
How much danger is there?
Richard's hand found the hilt of his sword.
If you join with the Order, Minister, you will wish it was the plague on you instead of me.
Colin had rarely seen two men so instantly and intently dislike each other. She knew Richard was exhausted and in no mood after having just seen so many seriously ill or dead children to be challenged by a noble such as Tristan inquiring after his own hide. Jarrah had also been on the council that had condemned Colin to death. Although it wasn't Tristan who had voted to behead her, it had been a counselor from his land. Richard had killed that Jarrian counselor. Colin didn't know why Tristan took such an instant dislike to Richard, except for the fact that this was the man who had demanded Jarrah's surrender. She guessed that was reason enough. If she were in his place, she might feel the same. Colin was expecting the two men to draw steel any second. Drefen stepped between them.
I'm Drefen Rawl, High Priest of the Rockmoss Community of Healers. I've had some experience with the plague. I suggest that you confine yourself to your room and avoid contact with strangers, especially prostitutes. Beyond that, you should get enough sleep and proper healthful food. Those things will help to keep your body strong against the distemper. Also, I will be speaking to the staff here at the palace on strengthening oneself against illness. You're welcome to come and hear my guidance, as is anyone else of a mind.
Tristan had listened earnestly to Drefen. He bowed, thanking him for his advice.
Well, I appreciate the truth, Lord Rawl. A lesser man might have tried to deceive me about such a serious problem. I can see why you're so busy. I'll take my leave so that you may see to your people.
Verdine nudged up beside Richard as he glared after Tristan's departing back. As intently as she had been studying the journal, muttering to herself, testing the pronunciation of High Dharan words, Colin doubted she had heard anything that had been said.
Lord Rawl, I need to talk to you, Verdine mumbled.
Richard put a hand on her shoulder in a signal for her to wait.
Drefen, Nadine, do either of you have anything for a headache, a really bad headache?
I have some herbs that will help Richard,
Nadine offered.
I have something better.
Drefen leaned closer to Richard.
It's called sleep. Perhaps you recall having experienced it in the past?
Drefen, I know that I've been awake for a while, but many days and nights... Drefen held up a finger. If you try to mask the outcome of lack of sleep with so-called remedies, you do yourself no service. The headache will return worse than before. You will ruin your strength.
You will be no good to yourself or anyone else.
Drefin is right, Collins said. Without looking up, Verdine turned the page she was reading in the journal. I agree. I feel much better since I got some sleep.
Verdine seemed to have finally noticed that there were other people around.
Now that I'm alert, I can think better.
Richard warded their insistence with a lifted hand. I know. Soon, I promise. Now, what was it you wanted to tell me, Verdine?
What?
She was reading again.
Oh, I found out where the Temple of the Winds is.
Richard's brow went up.
What? After I got some sleep, I could think more clearly. I realized that we were limiting our search by looking for a limited number of key words, so I tried to think of what the old wizards would do in their situation. I reasoned that...
Where is it?
Richard bellowed. Verdine finally looked up and blinked.
The Temple of the Winds is located atop the Mountain of the Four Winds.
Verdine noticed Raina for the first time. The two women smiled in greeting, their eyes sharing a private warmth. Colin shrugged to Richard's questioning look.
Verdine, that's not much help unless you can tell us where it is.
Verdine frowned a moment and then waved an apology.
Oh, sorry. That's the translation.
She frowned again.
I think.
Richard swiped a hand across his face.
What does Kolo call it?
Verdine flipped the page back and turned the book, tapping a finger at a place in the writing. Richard squinted.
Berglandersch ost Kimmer most, he read from the journal. Mountain of the Four Winds.
Actually,
Verdine said, Berglandersch means more than just mountain. Berglin is mountain, and Dersch can sometimes mean rock, though it can also mean other things like strong-willed. But in this case, I think it means something more along the lines of rock mountain, or great mountain made of rock. You know, rocky mountain of the four winds, something like that.
Colin shifted her weight on her tired feet. Mount Kimmermost.
Verdine scratched her nose.
Yes, that sounds like it could be the same place.
That has to be the same place, Richard said, looking hopeful for the first time in hours. Do you know where it is?
Yes. I've been on Mount Kimmermost, Colin said. There's no doubt about its being windy up there, and rocky. There are some old ruins atop the mountain, but nothing like a temple.
Maybe the ruins are the temple, Verdine offered. We don't know how big it is. A temple can be small.
No, I don't think so in this case.
Why? Richard asked. What's up there? How far is it?
It's not far to the northeast. Maybe a day's ride, depending. Two at the most. It's a pretty inhospitable place. As treacherous as the old trail going up and over the mountain is, going over Mount Kimmermost prevents you from having to go through some very difficult country and saves days of travel. At the top is the site of some old ruins, just some kind of outbuildings from the look of them. I've seen a lot of grand places. I recognize architecturally that what's up there isn't the main structure. There's something like the outbuildings here at the Confessor's Palace. There's a road through the buildings, a bit like the Grand Promenade here going through the outbuildings.
Richard hooked a thumb behind his wide leather belt. Well, where does it go, this grand road?
Colin stared into his gray eyes. Right to the edge of a cliff. The buildings are at the edge of a cliff. That sheer stone wall drops off for maybe 3,000 or 4,000 feet.
Is there any kind of stairway carved in the cliff? Something leading down to the temple itself?
Richard, you don't understand. The buildings are hard on the edge of the cliff. It's obvious that the buildings, walls, and the road itself went on because they're sheared off abruptly right at the edge. There used to be more of the mountain there. It's gone now. It's all fallen away. A rock slide or something. What was beyond the ruins, the main structure and the mountain, is gone.
That's what Kolo said.
The team returned and the Temple of the Winds was gone.
Richard looked devastated.
They must have used magic to tear away the side of the mountain, to bury the Temple of the Winds so no one could ever go there again.
Well, Verdine sighed, I'll keep looking in the journal to see if he says anything about the Temple of the Winds falling in a rock slide or avalanche.
Richard nodded. Maybe there's more about it in the journal.
Lord Rolf, will you have time to help me before you go off to be married?
A chill silence filled the grand hall.
But, Dean...
Richard's mouth worked, but no more words were forthcoming.
I heard the soldiers are well, Verdine said, looking briefly at Colin and then back at Richard. You told me that you and the Mother Confessor would be leaving to be wedded just as soon as the soldiers were well. The soldiers are well.
She grinned.
I know that I'm your favorite, but you haven't changed your mind, have you? Gotten cold feet?
She waited expectantly, seeming not to notice that no one was smiling at her joke. Richard looked numb. He couldn't say it. Colin knew that he feared speaking the words, fearing he would break her heart.
Verdine,
Colin said into the heavy hush, Richard and I won't be going away to be married. The wedding is called off, for now anyway. Even though she had whispered the words, they seemed to echo off the marble walls as if she had shouted them. Nadine's intently blank face spoke more than if she had grinned. It was somehow worse that she didn't, because it made it all the more obvious that she was schooling her expression. Yet no one could have cause to reproach her.
Called off?
Verdine blinked in astonishment.
Why?
Richard stared down at Verdine, not daring to look at Colin. Verdine, Jagang started a plague in Aiden Drill. That's what the prophecy down in the pit was about. Our duty is to the people here, not to our own... How would it look if... He fell silent. The journal in her hands lowered.
I'm sorry.
Chapter 32 Colin stared out the window at the falling night, at the falling snow. Behind her, Richard sat at his desk, his gold cloak laid over the arm of his chair. He was working on the journal with Verdine while he waited for the officers to arrive. Verdine did most of the talking. He grunted occasionally when she told him what she thought a word meant and why. Colin didn't think that as tired as he was much used to Verdine. Colin glanced back over her shoulder. Drefin and Nadine were huddled together beside the hearth. Richard had asked them to come along to answer any questions the generals might have. Nadine confined her attention to Drefin, scrupulously avoiding looking at Richard, and especially at Colin, probably because she knew that Colin would detect the glint of triumph in her eyes. No, this wasn't a triumph for Nadine. For Shota, this was only a postponement, just until... Until what? Until they could halt a plague? Until most of the people of Aidendrill died? Until they themselves got the plague and died as the prophecy foretold? Colin went to Richard and laid a hand on his shoulder, desperately needing his touch. Thankfully, she felt him put a hand over hers.
A postponement, she whispered as she leaned close to his ear. This doesn't change it, Richard. This only delays it for a little while, that's all. I promise.
He patted her hand as he smiled up at her.
I know.
Kara opened the door and leaned in.
Lord Rawl, they're coming now.
Thanks, Kara.
Leave the door open and tell them to come in.
Raina lit a long splinter in the hearth. She put a hand to Berdine's shoulder to balance herself as she leaned past to light another lamp at the far end of the table. Her long, dark braid slipped over her shoulder, tickling Berdine's face. Berdine scratched her cheek and gave Raina a brief smile. To see those two touch or even acknowledge one another in front of others was rare in the extreme. Colin knew that it was because of the things Raina had seen that day. She, too, was feeling lonely and in need of comfort. As deadening as their training had been, as numb as they were to agony, their human feelings were beginning to be rekindled. Colin could see in Raina's dark eyes that witnessing children suffer and die had affected her. Colin heard Kara out in the hall telling men to go in. Muscular, graying General Curson, looking as imposing as ever in his burnished leather uniform, marched through the doorway. Muscles bulged under the chain mail covering his arms. Behind him came the commander of the Celtic forces, the robust General Baldwin. He was an older man with a white-flecked, dark mustache, the ends of which grew down to the bottom of his jaw.
As always, he looked distinguished in his green silk-lined serge cape, fastened on one shoulder with two buttons. A heraldic emblem slashed through with a diagonal black line dividing a yellow and blue shield was emblazoned on the front of his tan surcoat. Lamplight flashed off his ornate belt buckle and silver scabbard. He looked as fierce as he was dashing. Before the phalanx of officers accompanying them had all entered the room, both generals were bowing. In the lamplight, General Baldwin's pate shone through his thinning gray hair as he bent low.
"My queen," General Baldwin said.
"Lord Rawl."
Colin bowed her head to the man as Richard stood, pushing his chair back. Burdeen scooted her chair over to be out of his way. She didn't bother to look up. She was Maud Sif, and busy, besides.
"Lord Rawl,"
General Curson said with a salute of his fist to his heart after he had straightened.
"Mother Confessor."
Behind them, the officers were all bowing. Richard waited patiently until it was all finished. Colin imagined that he couldn't be eager to start. He did so simply.
"Gentlemen,
I regret to inform you that there is a plague upon Aiden Drill."
"A plague?"
General Curson asked.
"A plague of what?"
"A distemper. A plague that makes people sicken and die, that kind of plague." "The Black Death," Dreffen put in with a somber voice from behind Colin and Richard. The men all seemed to take a collective breath. They waited in silence.
"It started not long ago," Richard said.
"So fortunately, we will be able to take a few precautions. As of this moment, we know of less than a couple of dozen cases. Of course, there is no telling how many have it and have yet to fall ill. Of the ones we know were stricken, almost half are already dead. By morning, the number will grow." General Curson cleared his throat.
"Precautions, Lord Rawl. What precautions are there to be taken? Do you have another cure for the men, for the people of the city?"
This is the end of Side 2. You should now change the balance control to the full right position and listen to Side 1 again, this time hearing Part B. Simply reverse this cassette, adjust the balance control to full right, and continue. If using the book cassette adapter, place the switch in the B position.